Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on quacks and quackery when we come back. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and they helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for our country. Today, more than half of the food that we eat is imported from outside our borders. Our food is being produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it is nutritionally deficient. Adolf Stembron of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feed. When compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Stembron's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese. And the same result has also been observed in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. And in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the Archives page and download the free General Law CD package right there off your computer. If it doesn't work on georgegordon.org, try georgegordon.com, georgegordon.com. Hey, we're talking about quacks. Now, we've been looking at the history of the American Medical Association and their definition of quacks and quackery. After all, they're the authorities. They're the ones that created it. And they, in 1868, came up with a definition for quacks and quackery. And the AMA fits the definition perfectly. But, hey, listen, it wasn't until 1962 that they really got their act together. About 1962. Now, at this point in time, we come to the most amazing record of criminal syndicatism in our history. Remember, after Congress had passed stringent requirements in 1962 to force the drug manufacturers to prove that their drugs were effective, a requirement which in many cases was impossible to observe since these drugs were worthless. The drug manufacturers were advised by their cohorts in the AMA and the advertising industry that it would be wise to start a brush fire, a diversionary tactic which would draw attention away from the AMA and the fact that they had failed to comply with the new congressional requirements. This diversionary tactic was to be called the War on Quackery. And a few months after the new regulations went into effect, the American Medical Association Board of Trustees met to create a new committee. This new committee on quackery, which was formally incorporated on November the 2nd, 1963, so it's a separate corporation from the AMA, owned by them, and it's called the War Against Quackery, and it was originally intended to destroy the entire profession of chiropractic in the United States. So their number one target was the nation's second largest health care group. I mean, after all, when you've got competition, why not drive them out of business? Well, it soon branched out in search of further victims as the Coordinating Conference on Health Information. So they've got two committees, one, the War Against Quackery, and the second, the Coordinating Conference on Health Information. This subsidiary was the brainchild of a New York letterhead outfit called the Pharmaceutical Advertising Council. So it was a corporate front, which in turn was merely a space on the desk of the president of Gray Medical Advertising Company, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of the prestigious Gray Advertising Company of New York City. Now, although it was ostensibly merely an advisory group, the Coordinating Conference on Health Information soon launched an all-out war on independent health practitioners all over the United States. Its victims were usually selected by the nonprofit AMA, aided by the charitable foundations, the American Cancer Society and the Arthritis Foundation, for a couple of examples, both of which had been smarting under accusations that they were killing their patients while independent health advisors were saving their patients. Now, the criminal syndicate was able to enlist the full police powers of the federal government through contacts in the Federal Trade Commission, the Post Office Department, and the Food and Drug Administration and the United States Public Health Service. These federal agents and agencies were solicited by the charitable foundations to initiate police actions against hundreds of unsuspecting health practitioners throughout the United States. It was one of the most massive, well-planned, and successful, ruthless operations in which the federal agents ever engaged. In many cases, people were arrested for selling or sometimes giving away booklets which advertised such innocuous health practices as taking vitamins. These health distributors now found themselves under restraining orders from the Post Office, the Department of Justice, and the Food and Drug Administration. Others who were distributing various salves, nostrums, and other preparations, most of them based upon herbal formulae, received heavy fines and prison sentences. In every case, all of the stocks of these practitioners, many of whom were elderly and impoverished, were seized and destroyed as being dangerous substances. Now, the government never alleged that a single person had ever been injured, much less killed, by any of these preparations, and still haven't to this day. At the same time, the drug manufacturers were continuing to sell their drugs, which produced extensive side effects, such as kidney damage, liver damage, and death. Not one of them was ever enjoined from distributing these products on the terms used against the independent health practitioners, nor are they to this day. In most cases, when these dangerous drugs were banned in the United States, the manufacturers shipped them overseas to countries in Latin America and Asia, where they continue to be sold to this day. The stock of Syntex Corporation rose from a few dollars to a high of $400 a share when it started dumping steroids in foreign markets. Many of the attacks were focused against the distributors of an anti-cancer preparation called Laetril, a fruit product, extremely sensitive to any rival of their very profitable chemotherapy drugs, and cancer profiteers ordered the federal agents to carry out terrorist raids against their competitors, often striking at night in groups of heavily armed SWAT teams. The federal agents broke down doors to capture elderly women and their stocks of herbal teas. Many of these housewives and retired persons carried small amounts of vitamins and health preparations, which they furnished to neighbors or friends at cost. They had no funds to fight this massed government agency and agencies of the federal government, who themselves were merely patsies for the drug trust. In many cases, the victims lost their homes, their life savings, and all their attachable assets because they had posed to a threat to the medical monopoly. It was the most blatant use of the police power by the big rich to protect their profitable enterprises. And to this day, most of these victims have no idea that they were knocked off by the Rockefeller monopoly. Sidney W. Bishop, Deputy Postmaster General, boasted at the Second National Congress on Medical Quackery in 1963, "I am particularly proud of the excellent arrangements existing between the Food and Drug Administration, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Post Office Department to maintain coordination in the exchange of information leading to the establishment of criminal prosecutions." A laudatory reference to the success of the war against quackery. And it was later revealed that the coordinating conference on health information had been entirely financed by the leading drug companies of the medical monopoly. Lederle, Hoffman LaRoche, and others. From 1964 to 1974, their search and destroy campaign was carried on as a total war by federal agents against anyone who had ever offered any type of health food or health advice. The goal, of course, was the elimination of all competition to the major drug companies. In 1967, the American Medical Association received 43% of its total income of $13.6 million from its drug advertisements. It then issued a letter of agreement jointly with the Food and Drug Administration, publicizing a campaign to enhance public awareness of health fraud devices and products by identifying them as ineffective and potential health hazards. Let me pause here and point out something. This is genius, absolute genius. In 1962, Congress comes against the drug manufacturers and says, look, you got 3,000 drugs out there that are no good. They don't work. Take them off the market. So the drug manufacturers get together with the AMA, the Food and Drug Administration, the Post Office Service, and the Federal Trade Commission. Then they set up a couple of dummy corporations, one a group against a committee against quackery. Then they start off with these government agents and agencies, and they attack the chiropractors and the independent health practitioners of the country who had never killed anybody, never damaged anybody. Nobody ever complained about them. Not one complaint against any of them. There's thousands of them out there. Nobody ever complained about them. Put them in jail, knocked out their businesses, and eliminated their competition and used the government to do it. Now, boys and girls, that's genius. Give credit where credit's due. Now they've got your children captive in your public schools as they tell your children that they're the heroes and that they're protecting them against quacks. I mean, it's almost like putting a pedophile in charge of a daycare center, isn't it? Talk about conflicting interests here. But hey, listen, it not only worked it works. It's a proven program that has always worked in the past. It works today, and there isn't any reason to believe that it won't continue to work in the future. Now, these were the same people who had been unable to persuade the drug companies to comply with federal requirements that they prove the effectiveness of their drug products. The hazards, as we have stated, lay more with the drug trust than from the elderly or old ladies in California who were advising people to eat more garlic and lettuce if they wish to stay healthy. The death tolls were from approved drugs, not from the preparations distributed by the holistic health advocates. So here are the quacks that the AMA and the drug and pharmaceutical manufacturers, they go out and create these dummy corporations, and then with government agencies, they attack the very people who hadn't caused any damage, their competitors. This got everybody's mind on quacks and quackery as being chiropractors and old ladies advising you to eat garlic and take vitamins. Garlic and vitamins never harmed anybody. Laetrile never killed or harmed anybody. But these drugs did, and they do, and they will continue to. And everybody's mind is on quacks are chiropractors and vitamin pushers, and the heroes are the drug manufacturers and the allopathic medical practitioners with the American Medical Association, the Food and Drug Administration. Now, isn't that a renvoi on reality? Now, the AMA then sponsored a national health fraud conference whose principal spokesman was Congressman Claude Pepper. This was an ironic turn of events because a few years earlier, the then Senator Claude Pepper, one of the most powerful political figures in Washington, had aroused the ire of the AMA because he planned to support socialized medicine in the United States. A longtime spokesman for left-wing interests who was known as Red Pepper because of his political sympathies. Pepper had found himself attacked by the big guns and the money of the AMA. They found a candidate to oppose him in Nixon's friend George Smathers, and Pepper was defeated in Florida. Coming back as a congressman, Pepper now licked the boots of those who had ousted him. He endorsed their police state methods against anyone who dared to challenge the power of the medical monopoly. I observed this personally up in Idaho. We had a senator up there in Idaho. And see if I can remember his name now. It kind of slips my mind. He was a Democrat, been in the Senate for 24 years. And a young fella out in Canyon County, or Owyhee County, I guess maybe it was Owyhee County, ran against him. And the young farmer out there that ran against him, you know, was a Republican. And he was a pretty good old boy, and a good farmer, good conservative guy. And then he went to he defeated the Democratic senator, and then he went to Washington. He only served one term. Now, in the 6 years that this young fellow was in Washington, you could not tell his votes from his predecessor. And I'll tell you what I think happened. I think that most people have a few skeletons in their closets, you know, like he's probably out here to Flo's whorehouse a time or two, and maybe he had a mistress in the closet, or, you know, something was going on that's probably not too kosher, you know, something that he probably didn't want his mother and dad to know about, or anybody else for that matter. And so, just like this guy that we heard about here yesterday or day before, who went into Simmons at the AMA back about 1907 and had the dirty linen on him or the dirty laundry and said, "Now approve my products or I'm going to go spill the beans." I think that's what they did to this young senator. See? Church was the senator that was ousted, and Steve Sims was the senator that ousted him. So I think Frank Church, the Democrat, he was the insider. He voted for the Panama Canal giveaway. That ticked off most Idahoans, and so they voted him out and voted Steve Sims in. And Steve Sims, I think they got the goods on him, because he voted for the same kinds of socialist programs that we sent him there to vote against. But, hey, listen, I think they got to him. And that's what happened to this Senator Claude Pepper, this Representative Claude Pepper. So it's a pretty standard operating procedure. The guy that you send to Washington more than likely is going to have some dirty linen. And then when that dirty linen is aired, you know, then they got you. Then you get angry, and then you vote them out of office. Now, having proved his loyalty to the Rockefeller power, Claude Pepper was allowed to stage another health conference in 1984. It was denounced by informed observers as a typical Moscow show trial. The new Pepper sideshow was called the Congressional Hearings on Quackery. Pepper claimed that health fraud was a $10 billion a year scandal, an impressive figure for what was essentially a small cottage industry. He summoned a longtime apologist for the medical monopoly, Dr. Victor Herbert, a physician at the Bronx Veterans Administration Hospital. Herbert demanded that the Justice Department use the RICO racketeer-inspired criminal organization strike force against medical charlatans and health frauds by using the same techniques which had been employed against organized crime. RICO allows the government to confiscate all of the assets of those who are convicted as a result of a proved conspiracy. In December of 1987, this same Dr. Victor Herbert surfaced again, filing a 70-page complaint in the U.S. District Court in Iowa. He charged that the officials of the National Health Federation, a rival to the AMA and other alternative health care practitioners, had libeled him. Kirkpatrick Dillon, the attorney for the defendants, termed the suit a flagrant attempt to destroy freedom of choice in health care in the United States. Dillon pointed out that Herbert was backed by a shadow group called the American Council for Science and Health, a front for the major food manufacturing companies. Dr. Herbert was joined at the Pepper hearings by a longtime agent of the medical monopoly, Mrs. Anna Rosenberg. She voiced her outrage that there should still be any competition in the United States for the drug trust. A longtime vassal of the Rockefeller family, she had served as director of the American Cancer Society during its valiant struggle to restrict all treatment to the orthodox and highly profitable cut, slash, and burn techniques, which, unfortunately for the patients, usually proved to be fatal. Anna Rosenberg had been married to Julius Rosenberg. She earned $5,000 a week as labor relations specialist to keep unions out of Rockefeller Center and to keep its underpaid minions on the job. The Coordinating Conference on Health Information ran amok for some 10 years, sending hundreds of victims to prison on what were, in most instances, flimsy or trumped-up charges. The desired effect, to terrorize anyone who had become active in the alternative health care fields, was achieved. Most health practitioners went underground or closed up their businesses. Others left the United States and went to Mexico or South America. An inevitable reaction against these terrorist operations set in by 1974. There were public demands for a congressional investigation of the SWAT tactics used by the Post Office and the U.S. Public Health Service against elderly housewives. Such an investigation would inevitably have revealed that these conscientious and dedicated public servants were actually faceless tools of the sinister, behind-the-scenes figures who manipulated the government of the United States for their own power and their own profit. Needless to say, no such congressional investigation was ever held. Instead, the CCHI suddenly went underground. They were immune from countersuits by their victims because all actions had been taken against the victims by federal agents, and the 11th Amendment protects the government. They were not immune according to the statutes, but the chances of recovering against them in any federal court was remote. The present writer was on numerous occasions sought, or has sought, redress against federal agents in federal courts, only to have a polite federal judge rule against him in every instance. Now, after the Coordinating Conference on Health Information went underground, health practitioners in the state of California suddenly found themselves under more concerted attack than ever before. The activist now was the California State Board of Health. It was then found that the stealthy minions of the CCHI, still doing the work of the medical monopoly, had merely abandoned their national operations for fear of exposure, but now had nested in the California State Board of Health like a group of diseased rats hiding from inevitable retribution. So the CCHI has remained embedded in the California State Board of Health ever since, carrying on a steady warfare against health practitioners in the country's largest state. The drug cartel continued to operate unmolested. This war against American citizens fulfills every requirement for prosecution under the statutes forbidding criminal syndicalism in the United States. It's a classic case of a supposedly nonprofit organization, the American Medical Association, conspiring with certain charitable foundations, notably the American Cancer Society and the Arthritis Foundation, to enlist public agencies to start a war to benefit the National Drug Trust while denying American citizens the benefits of reasonably priced and effective health care. Not only were there repeated violations of the constitutional rights of citizens who were active in the healthcare movement, often from a sense of public service rather than from a desire for profit, while the evidence of an active conspiracy, RICO, to subvert official government agencies for the profit of private multinational drug firms is too abundant to ignore. Those who have been victimized by the CCHI conspiracy can also bring actions against Lederle, Hoffman LaRoche, and other drug firms who hired these people to do their dirty work. The trail of liability is plain, and it'll be easy to establish in court. But who has the money, or the time, or the expertise to take on these huge multinational corporations with such deep pockets? Meanwhile, the effect of the CCHI depredations has been devastating. Millions of Americans, and particularly the elderly and the poor, have been forcibly deprived of reasonably priced health care because of this conspiracy. These victims have been forced to do without their modestly priced health advisors and thrown onto the care of the high-priced physicians from the American Medical Association, who placed them on expensive drugs produced by the Rockefeller drug monopoly. The fact that many of these drugs are overpriced, ineffective, and potentially dangerous has been routinely covered up by the same agencies and institutions responsible for protecting the public and the public interest, particularly the Food and Drug Administration. Now, it's notable that the drug cartels have never been investigated by any government agency under the pertinent provisions of the Sherman Antitrust Act, because these cartels are the property of international financial monopolies. And this proves that many observers, or what many observers have charged for years, that the government regulations purportedly enacted by Congress to protect the public have in reality served only to protect the monopolies. By 1986, this medical monopoly had reached a yearly take of $354 billion a year, 11% of the gross national product of the United States. It's up to 16% now. The medical monopoly has long had its critics among conscientious members of the medical profession. In December of 1922, the Illinois Medical Journal featured an article which declared that the American Medical Association has become an autocracy. This was during the heyday of Dr. Simmons' rule in Chicago. The article denounced the dictatorial assumption of power over the entire medical profession by Simmons and the AMA. Although it had first organized in 1847, the AMA had not formally incorporated until 1897, when it paid a $3 fee to the Secretary of State of Illinois. Within 2 years after its incorporation, Doc Simmons had arrived on the scene to begin his 25-year power grab. He soon realized that the medical schools control the hospitals. The medical examination boards control the medical schools, and so he expanded the power of the AMA until he had control of the medical examination boards. Now, the records show that coincidentally with the growing power of the AMA, there came a corresponding decline in the quality of medical care and the personal responsibility of the physicians to their patients. The AMA enacted a stern code of ethics which served to form a phalanx of protection for any physician who faced criticism for his errors. Such errors, in many cases, resulted in the crippling or deaths of his patients. This same code usually prevents any physician, nurse, or other hospital employee from testifying in court about the errors committed by a physician. One noted physician, Dr. Norman Barnsby, who had long been a prominent member of the U.S. Army medical staff and the U.S. Public Health Service, said chaos and crime is inevitable so long as doctors abide by the AMA code of ethics, the code of silence. This is akin to the notorious Omertra, the code of silence of the mafia, which invokes the death penalty to any member who reveals the secrets of the Cosa Nostra. The medical Gnostics, the AMA, has set up its own Cosa Nostra, which passes a sentence of professional death against any physician who reveals any medical omissions or crimes, the result being ostracism from the profession, denial of hospital privileges, and other drastic forms of punishment. The ethics to which doctors subscribe smells to high heaven. It is a disgrace to anti-vaunting civilization. A peculiar reserve must be maintained by physicians toward the public in regard to professional questions, and as there exist many points in medical ethics inadequate, through which the feelings of physicians may be painfully assaulted in their intercourse and which cannot be understood or appreciated by general society, neither the subject matter of their differences nor the adjudication of their arbitration should be made public. The last part of this paragraph is Dr. Barnaby's direct quote from the AMA Code of Ethics. Note the arrogance of the AMA in claiming that medical ethics and etiquette cannot be understood by general society. Dr. Barnaby continues, "I am convinced that the remedy lies in a full abolition of all codes and practices inimical to society, and to complete reorganization of the system on the lines of legal supervision or other responsible control." Dr. Barnaby his recommendations were ignored by the medical monopoly. An AP dispatch of February 11, 1988 noted that 5% of doctors lie about credentials, a headline of facts discovered by a large health corporation, Humana Incorporated, found that 39 out of 727 doctors who applied to work in their clinics during a six-month period, that is 5% presented false credentials. Even worse, many doctors convicted of drug or sex charges in one state simply moved to another state and set up practice protected by the medical monopoly again. There have been horrendous stories in recent years about habitual sex offenders convicted in one state who go to another state and through their professional practice begin their careers of violating children once more. Now, how's that for a story? I put my mark here in the margin, give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, the medical monopoly, talking about the AMA, the American Medical Association. The book is called Murder by Injection, The Story of the Medical Conspiracy Against America by Eustace Mullins. That's spelled E-U-S-T-A-C-E, Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S, copyrighted 1988. You can get a copy of this book from BraveNewBookstore.com. BraveNewBookstore.com is the webpage address. Their address in Austin, Texas is 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, as in boy. Austin, Texas, 78705. 78705. They've got a phone number, too. The phone down there is 512-480-2503. Again, that's 480-480-2503. Let's try that once more. 512 area code 480-2503. All right, we're talking about a gifted physician, Dr. Ernest Codman, of a distinguished New England family, addressed the annual AMA convention on March 2, 1924, and here's what he said. He said, "I have notes on 400 registered cases of supposed bone sarcoma. All of these 400 registered cases, with few exceptions, are records of error and failure. I have many of the foremost surgeons and pathologists in this country convicted in their own handwriting of gross errors in these cases. Legs have been amputated when they should not have been, and left on when they should have been amputated." Now, Dr. Codman's speech left his audience dumbfounded. None of them challenged any of his statements, but his speech was deliberately hushed up by the AMA officials, and he wryly records that never again during his distinguished professional career was he ever asked to address any AMA meeting again. From time to time, other dissidents have appeared at the AMA meetings to engage in a brief skirmish as they voiced their objections and then disappear, forgotten in the all-consuming war to maintain the medical monopoly. Time magazine gave a brief summary of one such episode on June 6, 1970, with the headline, "Schizophrenic AMA," and the story noted that some 30 to 40 dissidents, young, idealistic doctors, had rushed the podium and taken over the AMA annual meeting for a few anxious moments. Their leaders denounced the American Medical Association from the lectern in vigorous terms. The AMA does not stand for the American Medical Association, it stands for the American Murder Association. Well, armed guards turned back members of other groups which sought to voice their dissatisfaction. The young intern vacated the platform and presumably is chief of surgery at some hospital today, having learned that you can't fight the system. Another dissident was Dr. Robert S. Mendelson, noted that in 1975, 787,000 women had hysterectomies, and that 1,700 of them died as a result of this surgery. He believes that half of these women could have been saved as their surgery was needless. The Washington Post noted on January 21, 1988, that most heart pacemakers may be unneeded. More than half are not clearly beneficial. The story noted that one American in 500 now has a pacemaker. This business is only 20 years old, but there are now 120,000 implants each year, a business taking in $1.5 billion a year. Greenspan complained that many internists are ordering them without consulting a heart specialist. Now, if you'll remember, last time I pointed out, doctors are in the business of making money. Now, let's just try this one out. Let's suppose that you've got a heart attack or had one, and you go to your doctor, and your doctor has a boat payment due, or an airplane payment, or a house payment due. And he says to you, "Now, Bob, you've just had a heart attack, and you're getting over your heart attack, but I'll tell you what I think we need to do. I think we need to put a heart pacemaker into your chest. Now, that's a $25,000 procedure, but I know you've got insurance because insurance paid your last round of bills." See where we're going with this? Now, it's akin to a story that I told you once before about Bob Jones University. Now, oftentimes patients who go into their doctors, just like clients who go into their lawyers, want to hear a particular story. They want to hear a particular answer. They're not interested necessarily in the truth. They have their minds pretty well made up. And so the doctor, or the lawyer in this case, they're just selling you what you want to buy anyway. I mean, I understand that. I'm not being critical of you doctors out there for selling your patients a bunch of crap that they don't need, can't use, shouldn't have, and ought to avoid. But, you know, they want them and you want to sell it. I mean, it's the perfect mix for sales. I don't deny that. But is there, in the course of professionalism, is there ever a course in honesty where we simply say to somebody, well, you can't get there from here? Well, anyway, Bob Jones University had a policy against interracial dating. And so somebody brought suit against the university, and in federal court they lost. And so Bob Jones appealed to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Circuit Court upheld the District Court's opinion. Their last stop was the U.S. Supreme Court. So they engaged a very prestigious Washington law firm to take their appeal to the United States Supreme Court. Now, any first-year law student should know and understand that a corporation under Hale versus Hinkle has no rights. Just looking at Hale versus Hinkle, page 74, in looking at the distinction between individuals and corporations, should be able to tell anybody, you know, an average plumber, carpenter, electrician, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar here, that Bob Jones University, a corporation, is going to lose in this match. Now, let's take the side of the law firm. The Washington law firm charged Bob Jones University $436,000 to take this appeal into the U.S. Supreme Court. What is the Washington law firm's business in life? It's representing clients before the Supreme Court. That's their product. That's what they sell. Bob Jones walks in the door. Now, if they were honest, they would have said, well, because of Hale versus Hinkle, and because you're incorporated, you cannot win. There's no need for you to spend $436,000 with us to go in and lose because, you know, you're guilty, and that's the end of the argument. Now, how in the hell is this law firm going to make money? How are they going to keep their doors open if they tell their clients, hey, wait a minute, you can't win? So the law firm said, well, God bless Bob Jones University. Thank God there are people like you that want to protect our Constitution and fight for truth and righteousness and honesty. Of course we'll take your case. For $436,000, we're going to go into the Supreme Court and see if we can't correct this travesty of justice, which is exactly what Bob Jones and the board of directors wanted to hear. And the law firm simply told them what they wanted to hear. You're right. And all the rest of these guys over here are wrong. And we're going to be your champion. And by God, we're going to go in there and fight for you. No, unfortunately, this is pretty well settled law. It's been around for a long time. I don't know if it's right or wrong or good or bad, but I'm smart enough to know that when Bob Jones went into the Supreme Court, the answer to the question had already been settled time and time and time again. You lose. You can't get there from here. And sure enough, the Supreme Court ruled against Bob Jones. But the law firm got paid their $436,000, and I'm sure that the Bob Jones people are sitting back saying, well, that dirty, low-down, no-good Supreme Court, those commie pinko fags have ruled against righteousness and God and justice and the Constitution, and they're wicked and evil fellows. More than likely. Now, I got to tell you here, kids, when you walk into a lawyer, he's going to tell you what you want to hear. That's what a salesman is paid to do. He tells you exactly what you want to hear. In fact, God himself made an observation about human nature. It's over here in Isaiah chapter 30, I believe it is. Let me see if I can find that quickly for you. It's a hell of a neat statement here. If I got it marked, I can probably find it. Isaiah 30. Yeah, here it is. It's chapter 30, verse 8. And he says, "Now go and write it before them in a table, and note it in a book, that it may be for the time to come forever and ever, that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Eternal, which say to their seers, see not, and say to their prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, but speak unto us smooth things, and prophesy deceit." Hell, we would rather listen to a lie that sounds good than to listen to the truth that tells us where the dog did it. So today, when your government, Tim Gaither and Ben Bernanke and your president tell you, hey, we're about to the bottom of this recession, and I see green shoots out here shooting up, and everything's going to be roasty toasty, and everything's going to be fine, that's exactly what you people want to hear. And your leaders, your princes, who beller in the halls of Congress for more gun control and more taxes, they tell you precisely what you want to hear. Because that's where the money's at. Now, the bottom line is that that isn't going to save your hind end from this catastrophe that's about to envelop us all. But hey, listen, it's been this way for thousands of years. People are motivated by vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. They have been from the Garden of Eden to this day, are now, and will continue to be in the future. Once in a while, you'll find somebody that says, well, maybe I ought to stop doing that. I did that over smoking years ago. I smoked for 9 years, enjoyed every puff, woke up one day and said, this isn't good for me. It's good for R.J. Reynolds and Liggett and Myers. I don't deny it. But this smoking thing isn't good for little Georgie Gordon. I think I better quit doing this. There's going to be a consequence. If I want to avoid lung cancer, I guess I got to quit smoking. I hated to give it up. It felt so good, you know. I love smoking. It's just like giving up Flo's Whorehouse. I never met a whore I didn't like. Have you? Any of you boys out there ever met a whore that you didn't like? Never met a con man that I didn't think was honest and truthful and sincere and really a nice guy. Con men, whores, preachers, politicians, my God, they all sound good, don't they? Never met a preacher I didn't like. Never met a politician that offended me. And tell you just exactly what you want to hear, don't they? Now, Dr. Mendelsohn, he was a guy that would tell you things that you didn't want to hear. You know, he'd tell you, hey, you're being taken advantage of. You're taking your kid to the pediatrician over there and you're killing him. You're giving him autism. You're giving him sudden infant death syndrome. You're killing your children. And you're causing yourself a lot of grief for no good purpose. Nobody wants to hear that. That's bad news. And so, Dr. Mendelsohn has also complained that terramycin was an ineffective antibiotic. Its major result being that it left children with yellow, greenish teeth and tetracycline deposits in their bones. He quotes the Boston Collaborative Drug Surveillance Program, which found that the risk of being killed by drug therapy in an American hospital was 1 in 1,000, and that 30,000 Americans died each year from adverse reaction to drugs prescribed for them by their doctors. Mendelsohn minces no words in his opinion of modern medicine. He calls it the Church of Death, whose four holy waters are immunization, fluoridated water, intravenous fluids, and silver nitrate. Mendelsohn dismisses all four as being of questionable safety. Okay, let me hit you that one with that one again. This guy Mendelssohn wasn't some lightweight. This guy was a doctor, medical doctor, allopathic medical doctor. He was a pediatrician, and he taught in a medical hospital. He's the guy that taught your daughter, your doctor, how to practice medicine. And as an instructor, as a teacher, he said, this is a bunch of BS. Now, times have changed. See, Mendelssohn said that they were killing 30,000 people a year with bad drugs. It's now up to 130,000 people a year that they admit to. The real number is more like a quarter of a million, but they don't admit that they're killing a quarter of a million, but they do admit they're killing 130,000. And President Clinton, back about 1998, said, hey, we got to do something about this. Nothing's ever been done, but at least, you know, to his credit, he said, you know, we ought to get busy and do something intelligent about killing 130,000 people a year. Now, there's 37 million hospital admissions per year. So if you took 37 million, let me just plug that one in here, 37.36, that's right. Let's divide that by 1,000. That would be 37,000 deaths, which is just about what Mendelssohn said it was, 37,000. Now that's back in the 1970s. Just in 1998 is when President Clinton made that announcement, made that observation. 130,000 a year killed by honest to God good doctors, mean well, I presume. We'll give them credit for that. But they prescribed, you know, a medication, as I mentioned in the last program or the one before it, that is five times stronger than your body can take. Kills a bunch of people as a result of it. And of course, these drugs are all approved by the FDA, aren't they? They're all tested by the drug manufacturers, aren't they? Are they dangerous and do they have side effects? Every one of them do. Do they kill people? You bet. Now, is that medical quackery? I'll leave it up to you to decide. But nobody was ever killed with Laetril, and they took those guys, took their Laetril, is a dangerous substance, never harmed anybody, never had a side effect. It's a necessary vitamin. Boys and girls, every one of you have to have Laetril or you will get cancer. You get Laetril from 100 different sources. You get it from seeds. And the most powerful source of Laetril is in peach and apricot seeds. So when you're deficient in Laetril, vitamin B17, we give you peach and apricot seeds, which is the highest concentration we know of. Nobody's ever gotten sick. Nobody's ever been killed. Nobody's ever been harmed. But many people have been jailed, prosecuted and jailed, and all of their stocks taken away. You don't see anybody doing that to doctors that caused horrible deformities with drugs now, do you? Now, the quacks are in control of the American Medical Association, the Food and Drug Administration, the Federal Trade Commission, and they unleash the power of the government against the honest guys out here that are trying to help people. How do you like that for a kettle of fish? All right, the copy of the book is called Murder by Injection, Eustace Mullins, and you get it from BraveNewBookstore.com. Meanwhile, let me remind you, since we're about the end of our program, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date, That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. Hey, we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.